Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent breathing people!
No. I am the father.
What's in the box?
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you all to hell!
Hello and welcome to another Slate spoiler special. I'm Sam Adams, a senior editor at Slate, and I am joined today via Skype by Matthew Desham, Slate's Nights and Weekends browbeat editor. Matthew, hello.
Hello.
This week we are spoiling Dr. Sleep, which is a sequel to The Shining. Both the Stephen King novel and the Stanley Kubrick movie, which are not entirely congruent. That is something we will be talking about quite a lot. It picks up for the most part in the present day, about 40 years after the events of the original movie, and we're still following Danny Torrance, the kid from that movie, now known as Dan, who is an alcoholic, kind of still struggling with his demons, literal and metaphoric. But before we get into the movie, there's another Slate show that we want to tell you about. It's called The Authority, Exploring the World of His Dark Materials. Join Slate's very own Laura Miller and Dan Coyce as they deep dive inside the world of HBO's adaptation of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials series. Subscribe to The Authority now, wherever you get your podcasts. Let's just start things off in the traditional way and just talk about whether or not we would recommend this movie or not. Mr. Desham, what say you?
I would say that if you're an enormous fan of The Shining, it's fun, but it comes from these two sources that don't really match. I don't know. It's like there's 2 hours of a pretty good vampire movie and then 30 minutes of The Shining. So if that's your thing, go for it.
I mean, whose thing is that not? Really?
Yeah.
I think if you're a huge fan of the original Shining, meaning the Kubrick movie in this case, this will probably interest you. You may also hate it for that reason. So it's a weird kind of chimera in that respect as well. I know people who are real kind of evangelical Stanley Kubrick fans who are just like horribly offended at the existence of this movie, and particularly the fact that it restages some of the kind of iconic scenes from the original. I thought that part was kind of interesting. I think the adapter director, writer director of this, Mike Flanagan, is kind of an interesting figure. He kind of came out of the more straight horror world through movies like Oculus and Sinister 2, and has gotten some more kind of mainstream exposure recently, mostly on Netflix. He did an adaptation of Stephen King's Gerald's Game, and then did The Haunting of Hill House, which is kind of an adaptation of Shirley Jackson as a series last year. And so now he's doing this. I think he's like an interesting figure. I think there are good aspects to this. I also think the movie like doesn't work. I think it is basically not very scary. Which is a bit of a problem in this movie. It may have something to do with Warner Brothers releasing a horror movie in the first week of November, which is kind of an insane time to release it, and the kind of lousy box office returns sort of indicate that. It is not like a movie I regret having seen, but it's not one that I can't exactly recommend either. So hopefully, even if you don't intend to see it, you will stick with us through this exploration of it, and we'll tell you everything that happened in it, as you might expect from a spoiler special. So we start off in 1980, and we are shortly going to pick up with Danny Torrance and his mother, Wendy. But before that, we are introduced to the most significant character in this sequel to The Shining, who is a woman, so to speak, named Rose the Hat. Played by Rebecca Ferguson as kind of an Irish woman. And so I very hard for me to not just call her Rose the Hat like every time, but I will... I will do my best not to, although I just was literally kind of walking around my house the day afterward, just going Rose the Hat, like over and over again. But I apologize for any of our Irish listeners for my mangling of your lovely dialect. So anyway, we find Rose the Hat kind of by a lake in Florida somewhere, which is where Danny and his mother have relocated after the events of The Shining, the movie, getting as far away from that kind of frigid locale as possible. Rose the Hat is kind of lingering by this lake. She seems like a very kind of nice, kind, you know, woman. Asks this little girl to come over and talk to her. And then while she is doing that, these figures kind of appear out of the woods and close in on the little girl. And then we cut away. Because we are spoiling this, we will tell you that those people we will eventually find out are a group of kind of quasi-immortal beings. I don't know exactly what to call them, monsters, sort of vampires, called the True Knot, who will track down people who have, the first movie calls The Shining, the kind of psychic abilities that Danny has, and will basically, and they particularly prefer children, and like to murder them in as horrible fashion as possible, and then kind of suck this steam, what they call, out of them, and they will feed off that. So we're going to be seeing a lot more of them from this point on. And then we catch up briefly with Danny and his mother. And this is where you get a real sense of what this movie is doing. You know, this is a few months after The Shining ends. These roles have been recast. You have Roger Dale Floyd playing the young Danny and an actress named Alex Esso playing Wendy Torrance, the role made famous by Shelley Duvall. They get the physicality of them just right, and it was a little kind of disarming for me because I didn't know the film was going to do that in the first place. And Alex Esso, I found really kind of nailed. I mean, Shelley Duvall's performance in that movie, in the original movie, is very kind of like high key and theatrical, and a lot of people find it extremely annoying. Our friend Bill Gutbury just wrote a great defense of it for Vulture, but. She is kind of, Alex Esso is kind of getting the essence of that Shelley Duvall performance, which is not an easy thing to get without, but not doing a caricature of it is in kind of a really interesting space. What did you think of that moment?
I think the first time that I thought, well, this is sort of The Shining, but not, the very first shot is of the Overlook's carpet. And then there's a sort of recreation of that Steadicam shot down the hallways, right? Like that's the title shot.
Right, the big wheel
where the
shot.
Camera follows yeah. little Danny on the big wheel around the hallways, and then he looks up at room, is it 237 in this, like yes. It is in the movie? Yeah, it's like those shots, and they're almost like in the film, but not quite. Like the camera moves differently, and the hair is like not quite right. I knew what they were doing with that. So when Wendy showed up, I already was like, okay, they're going to use, you know, actors doing it there.
What are your feelings about the original Shining? I mean, you're a person who kind of holds it sacrosanct, and
I love it. I also liked the book. I mean, the thing about it is, like when I said, if you're a fan of The Shining, you'll like this. I guess the question is, which Shining you're a fan of? Because I could see also why Stephen King would not have loved Kubrick's movie, but Kubrick's movie is terrifying. I mean, I would say that was the one thing that I thought was, as you said before, was different. This isn't a very frightening movie, and The Shining really was.
Yeah, this movie has a very kind of interesting and somewhat impossible task, which it is based on Dr. Sleep, which is a novel by Stephen King, which is the sequel to Stephen King's novel, The Shining. It is also kind of a, you know, Warner Brothers product and an extension of one of their more treasured pieces of intellectual property, which is Stanley Kubrick's movie, The Shining. Stephen King famously hates Stanley Kubrick's movie of The Shining to the extent that he kind of engineered to have a pretty terrible and entirely forgotten miniseries remake of it done in the late 1990s. And King's novel, which ends with, there's a whole, instead of the hedge maze thing, there is a whole thing where the Overlook's topiary comes to life. And then Jack Torrance ends up in the boiler room of the Overlook, which then kind of explodes and is destroyed and destroys him along with it. So Mike Flanagan has to kind of create a sequel that works as a sequel to both of those things, which are fundamentally incompatible, and under the guidance of an author who hates the original movie version of his book. So it's a servant of at least two masters and possibly more.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I thought that it was much more interesting as a work of like, how would you do this impossible adaptation than it is as just like a vampire movie or a horror film. Using actors sort of imitating those performances or doing riffs on those performances was an interesting way to do it. I mean, it's how you would have done it at any point in the past until, you know, 10 years ago or whatever. I mean, we're now in the age of reuse the footage or build a CGI, you know, fake version of Jack Nicholson at the time of The Shining. And I don't know if there were any other concerns rights-wise or actor participation-wise that prevented them from doing that, but I thought it was interesting to see them do it just completely analog like that.
Right. You know, sort of significantly later in the film, we will, of course, eventually return to, you know, the Overlook, recreation of it, and return to the character of Jack Torrance, who's going to be played in this movie eventually by Henry Thomas and not by a digitally de-aged Jack Nicholson. But we are introduced soon after this to another one of The Shining's characters who shows up in this movie, and that is the character of Dick Halloran, played, of course, by Scatman Crothers, and then killed by Jack Nicholson in the original. And he reappears here in the form of Carl Lumbly as a kind of guide to the afterlife, or, you know, still kind of a tutor for Danny in the ways of managing his shining. Dick informs Doc, as he still calls him, that, you know, the Overlook is, you know, more or less contained, but because of his shining, Danny is always going to be a target for the kinds of ghosts who visited him there. And in fact, we see one of them, the kind of naked old woman in the bathtub, reappear in Danny's bathtub. And Dick teaches him how to kind of create these boxes in his mind, which appear in the middle of the Overlook's hedge maze from the movie. And those are a way of kind of trapping those ghosts in there. So he uses his power. He's learned to use his power to kind of keep them at bay and contain them. But we get the sense also that he's going to be perpetually haunted by them. We see that comes true shortly after, because then the movie jumps forward briefly into 2011 and then into the present day, into 2019, where Dan Torrance, as he's now called, is first just a full-on alcoholic, and then eventually a recovering alcoholic. He's been using drink to kind of suppress his shining, to, you know, not have to see these horrible things. He bottoms out in 2011 and decamps for small town New Hampshire, which is where he resettles, and that's where the bulk of the story picks up. And we should mention at this point that the Dan Torrance, as he will be known for this movie, is played by Ewan McGregor in this, who is evidently with this and the returning to Obi-Wan Kenobi in the sort of he's in his retirement, the retirement nest egg phase of his career.
Yeah, accumulating houses.
So. Yes. I mean, so what did you think of the kind of grown up version of Dan Torrance? And have you read Dr. Sleep too? Is that right?
Yeah, I reread recently both of these books, and it's interesting because, again, it's in the novel The Shining, what Stephen King is interested in is Jack Torrance's struggle with alcoholism. And so writing a sequel to The Shining, what he's interested in is, you know, Danny Torrance's struggle with the trauma of the first novel and alcoholism. I mean, it's I think that works given the priors. I mean, given that that's what King is interested in and is trying to write about. If you'd never read either book and you were making a sequel to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, you might land on abuse, but I don't think you would land on drinking, because it's not, Kubrick was not as interested in that
right.
as King was.
Right, but that is a major.
So I think it works, yeah. But I think it only works if you accept the fact that this is Stephen King writing about what Stephen King cares about from that story, not necessarily what you care about from the movie.
And this ties in with a lot of the stuff that Mike Flanagan is interested in as a director too. This is a huge aspect of The Haunting of Hill House, which he turned into I guess I would say faithless Shirley Jackson adaptation for Netflix. It has its charms, but it is not Shirley Jackson's Hill House by any stretch of the imagination. That series works in a kind of dual time frame. You have the kind of the action of the book, which is where these kids in this house are haunted by these ghosts who have been there. And then, you know, most of the series, kind of increasingly more of it, is concerned with what happens to these kids as adults. And one of them grows up and becomes a sort of author and writes a book called The Haunting of Hill House and becomes a success. Several of the others become, you know, addicts or of one kind or another. One of them ends up killing herself, which is the kind of the event that kind of precipitates the whole series. And the kind of running theme in that adaptation is, you know, horror movies are often focused on children. They're about kind of being afraid of the dark, about these things that scare you. And then at the end, the kids kind of escape and everything seems to be fine. But, you know, the Hill House and Dr. Sleep are really about, like, okay, like, you're out of immediate danger, but, like, you're fucked up for life if that happens to you as a kid. Like, your dad doesn't try to kill you with an axe when you're five and then everything's fine. So picking up the story after 30, 40 years is kind of a way to really look at the lasting trauma of these kinds of things, which is an interesting, you know, the return of the repressed is such kind of a big element in horror, and it really really comes to the fore in a story like this.
And King, of course, like is, I mean, if you look at Haunting of the Hill House as a Shirley Jackson adaptation, it's not, you're not going to be happy. But if you look at it as an audition for a Stephen King movie with all that generational trauma and, in fact, a character who becomes a Stephen King-like author, it's a masterpiece. but yeah, exactly.
That's also the theme of It, which is the other sort of, you know, recent.
Yeah, I was just going to say It is the other big thing where King messes around with this. So we
pick up with Dan in 2011 and in 2019, and he's kind of trying to settle down in this New Hampshire town, make a kind of steady life for himself, get some menial jobs. He runs like a kind of toy locomotive for kids that drives around this town square. There's this whole thing there I wanted to ask you. They make a big deal about this town having this kind of small-scale replica of itself in the middle. It's called Teeny Town. And then, like, nothing happens with that in the movie. Is that a whole thing in the book? Or is that's just a symbol? That's just a symbol.
Either. I think it's as simple as that. Okay. You would think, given that the Kubrick film, I mean, maybe it's a joke about the hedge maze model that is in Kubrick's movie, but it doesn't have any plot significance.
Yeah, I mean, I could make something up about that being about kind of, you know, replicating the past, but it just seems like a very big, like, obvious symbol that's not quite of anything planted in the middle of the story, and then they don't do anything with it, which is weird. Yeah. And in addition to running this locomotive, he is also, I guess a nurse. I mean, I don't think they exactly specify, but he is some sort of health aide.
A hospice nurse.
Yeah, he's like a hospice nurse. And the title comes from the fact that he is primarily kind of using his shining now to identify when people are near death and to kind of guide them into the afterlife, because he can talk to dead people, more or less. He can see kind of the other side coming for them, and he is able to comfort them, even go into their mind and soothe them telepathically. And so then he is given the name Dr. Sleep, and that is where that comes from. Since we are also introduced around this time to one of the movie's other major characters, I think the last one we have to mention, which is Abra Stone, played by Kylie Curran. She is a young girl in 2011 and a teenager in 2019, who's also has, you know, like Dan Torrance, a very strong version of The Shining. And we see her in this kind of early scene, using her powers to make all her family's cutlery float up near the ceiling. And by the time she's a teenager, she has kind of gotten more creative with it, but doesn't really seem to realize exactly what she has. And more importantly, she does not know that having these abilities, and particularly using them, is going to make her a target for Rose the Hot and the True Knot.
So we've
been given the idea that Rose the Hat and her band of psychic vampires, or whatever we're calling them, have been operating this whole time. But by the time we catch up with them in 2019, they've kind of fallen on hard times. This steam that they live on, that they have been, torturing and killing, particularly children, in order to harvest this from them, has grown less powerful, less pure. They don't really know why. One of them says it might have something to do with cell phones. Thankfully, they leave it at that, because I really don't want to hear any more of that theory.
Midichlorian, obviously.
Yes, but we are made aware that they are still kind of active and up to their bad ways, because they track down a young man in Iowa at a Little League practice. Who turns out to be, I have to admit, I didn't even notice this in the film and had to see it in the credits, but it's played by Jacob Tremblay, which is sort of
Yeah, that was a surprise to me too.
Yes, but they offer him a lift after baseball practice as he's walking down these sort of cornrows, which might make you think of another Stephen King movie or Seven. but so they offer him a lift. He says no. Unbeknownst to him, one of the members of this True Knot is what they call a kind of a pusher. She has the ability to kind of, you know, just tell people what to do and get them to do it. So she says, you know, get in. He gets in. After that, they take him off to this kind of abandoned chemical factory or something, pin him down to the ground. And then there was like a fairly, I guess not graphic, but fairly kind of prolonged sequence where it is very clear that they are, you know, torturing him with a knife and kind of, you know, cutting into him, because Rose explains to him that fear and pain purify the steam and kind of basically get them a better high. You know, you do see kind of blood spattering up on his teenage boy face and stuff like that, which is pretty messed up, I guess. What did you think of that sequence?
Yeah, it's hard to watch. It's less chilling there than it was in the book. In the book, there's a point where the kid actually begs Rose the Hat to kill him, and she sort of like smiles at him as like, soon, and then the next sentence is, but it wasn't. So it's bad any way you look at it, but it is a pretty lengthy child torture sequence, so if that's not your thing. And I hope it's not. Be warned.
please let's do another podcast if that's your thing. Yeah. There are many to choose from. It is. And I think if you read, I used to read Stephen King books a lot. I've not read one in quite some time. You know, I read them as a child and a teenager, and I certainly remember he was someone who has no compunction about doing horrible shit to kids in his books, yeah. Which as a kid, I think was very compelling to me, because I guess you feel like people are trying to do horrible shit to you all the time. So anyway, so poor Jacob Tremblay gets killed. That is all she wrote for Jacob Tremblay. But then Rose the Hat and co kind of move on to, they realize Aberstone is out there and that her steam is very powerful and pure, and they can't quite figure out where she is, but they know she's kind of on the East Coast somewhere. So they start heading that way. And meanwhile, Dan Torrance and Abra have been building up this kind of sort of anonymous psychic communication. Dan has this kind of attic apartment in his New Hampshire town. There's some, you know, line of exposition about how the previous inhabitant was a math teacher or something, and so he painted a wall with blackboard paint. And then, you know, one day he just starts realizing that he can communicate with this other person, not knowing who it is, but through kind of drawing messages on there, and then messages from her will appear there. So he and Abra are kind of aware of each other's existence, but not actually in contact.
I got to say, this is the one part in both the movie and book where that didn't entirely ring true to me, because if you're Dan Torrance and as a kid you went to the Overlook Hotel and met all of these ghastly creatures, it seems to me that your response to like an unexplained psychic phenomenon would not necessarily be curiosity and excitement the way his seems to be in this.
Right.
Like the first message he gets from her is he wakes up one morning and on his blackboard someone has written hello with a smiley face after it, which maybe that's a good sign, but I don't know that I think Danny Torrance would assume that.
Yeah. I guess you maybe have to kind of read, that he shines, you know, something about that, I guess, that he kind of assumed. I watched the trailer for this movie, and I remember seeing that, and they made those shots seem quite creepy in the trailer, and, you know, kind of blackboard, crudely drawn smiley face in a horror movie can very much go either way. That is often not a sign of someone actually trying to smile and say hi to you.
But this Dan Torrance makes friends, so.
Yeah, you know, he's in recovery. He's doing good. He's able to reach out to other people. So there's a scene in here. The True Knot kind of eventually get a sense of where Abra is, and Rose the Hat she can astral project herself, as it turns out. I think this is one of the cooler sequences in the movie. She kind of flies through the air, vaguely Superman-y, but somehow different. I mean, she doesn't kind of have her arms extended. It's almost like she's kind of standing still and the world is moving around her or something. And that's just like a very cool, like kind of visually distinctive sequence. So she flies through the air, zooms in on Abra's house, walks in through her window upside down, and finds her room full of file cabinets, which is an idea that the movie just kind of mumbles a couple words about, I assume is a bigger thing in the book.
It's the way that Abra is visualizing, and also Rose the Hat, the inside of someone else's mind. So it seems like the person who owns the mind has some say in how it's decorated or whatever, but it's essentially she's going through Rose the Hat's memories is the idea there.
Right.
Or actually, the filing cabinet scene, we're in Abra's mind and Rose the Hat is trying to go through Abra's memories and it doesn't work out.
Yeah, so Rose the Hat is going through Abra's memories. She's going through these file cabinets. She turns around and sees Abra sitting there. She's wearing a wig and her face is blurry. She's kind of disguised her appearance. And at that point, this metal file cabinet basically kind of starts trying to eat Rose the Hat's hand. Slam shut on it. She can't get herself free. At that point, Abra manages to go into Rose the Hat's mind, which is sort of kind of like a library, but more like a kind of, you know, Harry Potter or like Library of Alexandria kind of deal, like with, you know, like a big cathedral with lots of little filing cabinets. Now she's rifling through Rose the Hat's memories and learning about her. Rosa Hat is trying to pull her hand free, and it basically is kind of coming out of the drawer in pieces. It reminded me a lot of Gerald's Game, particularly just reading the novel and getting to the word degloving and experiencing like a full body shiver. So her hand is kind of being pulled out of this thing, like one layer of flesh at a time. It's completely disgusting. Maybe the goriest thing in the movie, which maybe tells you a little bit about the movie too. But that's when Rose realizes that Abra is sort of like a foe that she hasn't really encountered before. I mean, they've gone after a lot of psychics before, but not, she just has a level of powers that they have not gotten to previously. And is that explained at all in the book, or is that just, she just kind of is that way for some reason?
It's like X-Men have different powers. Some people have this.
Right. And Danny is like that in the original too. I mean, Dick Halloran kind of explains to him, like, there are a lot of people who have like a little bit of The Shining and they kind of just, they get a feeling when it's time to play the lottery or something like that, or not to get on a certain plane. But Danny is special. Like, he has this, superlative version of him. That's what makes him so, vulnerable to the ghosts at the Overlook and eventually kind of like a beacon to the True Knot as well.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I wanted to ask about the True Knot as well. I don't know how they're portrayed in the novel. In this movie, there are several of them. Some of them you really have to look in the credits to even know. There are several of them in the movie. They have names like Grandpa Flick, Barry the Chunk, Silent Sari, Short Eddie, Apron Annie. Several of those that you would have to look in the credits to even know what the characters' names are. They're really just people who are in the background of a lot of scenes. But they do seem to have taken some trouble to kind of make them, slightly kind of, multi-ethnic and different ages and stuff like that. And Rosa Hat herself looks a little bit like, she's got a little bit like a sort of 1978, like Stevie Nicks vibe going on. She's got like, she's got her hat. She's got like kind of turquoise jewelry and beads in her hair and stuff like that. But it does feel to me like this is basically a group of people that Stephen King kind of wrote as like traveling, like kind of Roma clan of like breath stealers. And then was like, oh wait, shit, that's racist now. Like, I have to do something else. So what if I made them like one's Irish and one's Native American and then the others are white? Like, did they signify that way to you? Cause that just felt very like,
yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, they're a modern version of that, Roma myth plus the vampire myth. I mean, the thing that we haven't mentioned is that there's another thing about the True Knot, which is that people who have some amount of psychic power, who have a little shine or however you want to put it, like vampires, they can turn you into a member of the True Knot if you have that power. And we see them do that to a woman at some point early in the thing. It seems like a really painful process. But so in the book, the idea is just basically that for hundreds and hundreds of years, they've been traveling around the world. And every, 50 years or so, maybe somebody joins their group. So,
right. We see this turning scene at the beginning with a character who ends up being known as Snakebite Andy, who's a 15-year-old girl who has a thing about, she's the pusher, the one who can kind of get people to do what she says. And she has a thing about kind of luring pedophiles into her orbit and then basically using her powers to force them to harm themselves, kind of getting in what would be a compromising position with them and then getting them to mutilate their own faces, stuff like that. And Rose the Hat obviously thinks this would be a pretty powerful tool to have in her arsenal. So she, says to Snakebite, any kind of come with me, do you want to like live almost forever, live long, eat well, I think is the slogan. They open what's kind of this like magical, thermos of death that they use to collect the steam, you know, she snorts it, then kind of says later, like, oh God, I felt like I died. And Rosat says, well, you did. So they kill her without telling her they're going to kill her, but then she is reborn as one of these, you know, true knot people. And then does not seem to have any regrets about her career choices after that. So to return to the plot, by now, you know, Rose the Hat and her group know that Abra exists. They know that she is this very powerful, very tasty psychic whose steam they want to feast on. So they're not trying to track her down. And at the same time, Abra and Dan, who by now have kind of joined forces, they want to find them as well. And they decide that the way to do this is to Abra needs to get a hold of an item that belonged to the dead boy, Jacob Tremblay, the baseball player, because one of the members of the True Knot held it for a while. And so she can pick up emanations from that. So Dan Torrance and his AA sponsor, played by Cliff Curtis, then have to go out to Iowa and dig up this baseball glove. And they leave Abra at home with her family. Well, they go out and do that. They bring the glove back to her, and she is able to kind of make this psychic connection and see where they at, see that their True Knot are on the way at that point. And then they decide they're going to set a trap for them. And that leads to this kind of confrontation in the woods where most of the True Knot is wiped out. It turns out that despite being kind of quasi-immortal vampires, all you need to do is like shoot them with a rifle and they will dissolve. So Ewan McGregor and Cliff Curtis dispense with most of them. But unfortunately, they realize that one of the group is still missing, played by Zahn McLaren, who you may know from Westworld. And so he, meanwhile, has kidnapped Abra, killed her father, and is taking her back to Rose the Hat. Do you want to talk about what happens next?
So Crow Daddy, which is the name of this member of the True Knot who has kidnapped Abra, is keeping her drugged in a way that prevents her from using any of her powers, and driving her back. And they actually sort of have a conversation. She's relatively amiable since he believes he's won, although he's angry about everyone else being killed. And what Dan Torrance manages to do is sort of travel into Abra's mind. Dan Torrance possesses Abra and then uses her to, although she doesn't have any psychic powers, Crow Daddy is not particularly worried and is not wearing a seatbelt. So she just grabs the steering wheel and drives him into a tree, at which point he goes through a windshield and dies. She does not.
Psychic vampires are also very bad at wearing their seatbelts.
Yes, they are. It's very strange because they seem to have, I mean, this is not a movie. If you're somebody who likes horror movies for like learning the rules of their universe, this is not the movie for you, because the psychic powers that people have are whatever psychic power is narratively necessary at that moment. The vampires too, they seem pretty mortal. they just don't age. But they also don't seem particularly worried about being killed, which I would think you would be if you were torturing children and could be killed with a bullet. Anyway, he goes through the windshield and that's the end of that. At which point...
Poor Crow Daddy. We barely talked about you.
Yeah, I know. A short long life. Short on screen and long in years. But the death of Crow Daddy, who is also the lover of Rose the Hat, enrages
whatever that means in this context.
Yeah, exactly. She's enraged by his death and by the death of the rest of them. And at that point, she is hellbent on tracking down Abra.
So she goes on this big steam bender. She kind of takes all these canisters that she's been saving for the group. And because there is no group more, she just like snorts all of them, becomes, you know, super powerful and very dangerous. And Dan kind of realizes or gets some sense that this is going on and realizes that for reasons that don't entirely make sense, except that, you know, that we're going to get to the fireworks factory, decides that the only place that he can finally defeat Rose the Hat and make his final stand is, surprise, surprise, the Overlook Hotel.
So Dan and Abra go on a road trip to Colorado, and the first thing that you see that is recreated from Kubrick's movie after the opening credits there is sort of helicopter shots over the same lakes that are used for the opening shots of The Shining. And they arrive at the hotel, which is still standing, but has been condemned at some point after Jack Torrance's death.
Right. And as you explain, like, that's sort of an odd and slightly inexplicable move, given that, you know, the history of the Overlook is like far more horrible things have happened there than like a man attempting to kill his wife and child and freezing to death. Like, people have actually been murdered in significant numbers in this hotel, and it was fine. But I guess they hit a breaking point at some point and shut it down.
So the Overlook Hotel is now also a haunted house, which is a Mike Flanagan thing after Hill House. And really does look like, if you were going to design like the haunted house version of that hotel, what it would look like. In the book, the reason that they go to the Overlook is a lot more prosaic, and it's because Rose the Hat is there, because they bought the ground where the thing once stood, the True Knot has, and put in a mobile home thing. Like the Roma, they're migratory, but they travel around in lavish RVs. So there's a reason besides shining nostalgia for them to go there.
What did you think of these moments? I mean, we've gotten, as you said, you know, really from the beginning of the movie, we've gotten like little peaks of the Overlook. Here and there, you know, sort of brief recreations of some of those, you know, incredibly famous, kind of indelible scenes from Stanley Kubrick's original. But this is where they really go whole hog on that. And for, you know, to a certain extent, like the last half hour of Dr. Sleep kind of effectively takes place inside The Shining. They have, you know, meticulously recreated. I think there are a couple shots that they actually just swiped, like the shot of the blood kind of gushing out of the elevator, but they've recreated a lot. They've recreated a lot of the locations and hallways. They've, you know, recreated, you know, shot for shot some of the some of those moments, even just images that you immediately recognize, like when Danny, you know, when Dan goes up to a door on the Overlook and you see, you know, one of the panels has been busted out. I mean, you know exactly what room you're at. You know what happened there. How did you react to that? Was that kind of like interesting or weird? Did that feel kind of creatively sterile to you? Like,
well, I mean, I feel like the nostalgia you can get out of like, here's The Shining again, was pretty effectively mined in Ready Player One. And the first time that I realized that they'd recreated the look of that was more of a shock than this. This one, I was impressed. I think the first thing that they recreate that's just straight from the thing is that they stop for gas at the same gas station. It's literally like a gas station in the movie where Dick Halloran, I think, rents a snowmobile or something. That they had rebuilt. What I liked about it, I guess, is not that it was just, oh, they've rebuilt the sets, which you could do. I mean, that just takes money, but that it was sort of like, we've rebuilt what this place would look like if it had been sitting exposed to Colorado winters.
I mean, it's a very like bizarre thing. And I had a lot of mixed feelings about it, a lot of which I think are more complicated than the film itself. Like, I started to think about, there's a scene we kind of mentioned, the introduction of Snakebite Andy before, and there's that scene at the beginning where she has coaxed this pedophile to meet with her so that she can kind of get her revenge on him. And she does it in a movie theater, and you know, as they're walking away, you see the marquee underneath it says, you know, now playing Casablanca. And it's like, oh, you know, what a wonderful homage to like a great, you know, old Hollywood movie. But then you also kind of, or at least I realize, and I'm sure you know this too, you know, Casablanca, like The Shining, like Dr. Sleep, is, you know, owned lock, stock, and barrel by Warner Brothers. And especially as all these Hollywood studios are kind of marshaling all their content and preparing to launch, you know, their Disney Pluses and their Apple TVs and their HBO Maxes, where you would be able to no doubt watch The Shining and Casablanca come early next year. There is that aspect of it I find, you know, kind of like troubling. And the part of this movie that is just Warner Brothers exploiting its like pre-existing IP is like, that just is like, that's kind of the real horrifying part of it for me.
Of course.
When you get down to like recreating the sets of The Shining and like redoing the shots and actually like taking Henry Thomas and giving him that sort of like, you know, that kind of shaggy haircut and the kind of, you know, loose fitting cardigan that Jack Nicholson has in the, you know, at the end of The Shining. Then it becomes like this weird, it kind of started to remind me of like Gus Van Sant's like shot for shot remake of Psycho. It becomes like this weird conceptual art project and not just this kind of this like sterile recreation of it. Like, you know, like Rogue One or something like that. I don't know how in touch with the weirdness of that this movie is, and how much of it is just like kind of Kubrick fanboyism. But it's, you know, it's kind of set my brain, and part of this is just that at this point I was like not involved in the plot at all, but it just set my brain firing in like these, you know, 12 different directions as I'm like thinking about that stuff. And also at the same time, like not really caring what happens to Dan Torrance or ever. So
they definitely have some fun kind of playing around with the original text when they're back there. Well, I was just going to say, as a business decision that the Warner Brothers Studios has made, filming a sequel to The Shining is not something I necessarily approve of, but the attention to detail and the actual recreations of the rooms and things I thought was very, like, legitimately impressive. And, you know, the thing that I wondered most about it was how much of it was built and how much of it was just, let's build a digital Shining and green screen all of this.
Right. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I know Mike Flanagan is like kind of a practical effects guy when he can be. There's an episode of The Haunting of Hill House called Two Storms. It's kind of the midpoint of the series. And there it's a lot of it is like set in a kind of a funeral home where they are burying their sister Nell, who dies at the beginning of the series. But then it is also kind of going back to Hill House and recounting the things that happened there. And it starts off with this, I think, you know, 26-minute single take Steadicam shot that not only follows him around this funeral home, but actually like goes from the funeral home like down a hallway and then transitions into the main hallway of Hill House itself, goes back in time and reveals some of the things that are happening there. And I just assumed because it's, you know, as it passes through this hallway out of the funeral home into Hill House itself, that there was some, you know, digital cut hiding there, because it just clearly you wouldn't like build these two enormous sets next to each other and, you know, put in all that expense and logistical difficulty just for one shot so you could, you know, kind of physically travel between them. And I was wrong. Those two sets were actually built next to each other for the sole purpose of this one shot in the middle of this, you know, 10 and a half hours of TV. So he is, you know, I think pretty obsessive about that stuff. I'm sure there's some, you know, digital involvement here. You know, like I said, I mean, there are definitely you know, shots from the original Shining that are intermixed here, and there may be some kind of, you know, blending back and forth, but I think a lot of it is just construction and this, you know, the aging that you were talking about, this 40 years of Colorado winters give them some leeway. You know, it doesn't have to be a perfect recreation. You just kind of need to, you know, get the dimensions right and to make the numbers on the door of room 237 look like the numbers on the door of room 237, stuff like that. And I was thinking of Ready Player One, which also was, you know, very bizarre to have this whole, and again, like a big change from the book. They added this whole Shining sequence in the movie because that's a movie that Warner Brothers owns. And then they were making Ready Player One and it was like, well, we own the Shining. Why don't you just use that? You know, and I have a lot of deeply ambivalent feelings about that movie as well, but I did, and I do end up feeling after seeing Dr. Sleep that it was at least a more sort of interesting, you know, thoughtful, if not, again, not totally successful kind of reckoning with just what this era of kind of endless, you know, remakes and reboots and IP mining and extensions and everything else, the kind of, you know, creative cul-de-sac that is pushing us into. And it felt like Dr. Sleep is kind of doing that, and but not necessarily thinking about it as much.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, actually, because if you think about what King was doing when he wrote the novel of Dr. Sleep, it's not intellectual property that would be particularly valuable to Warner Brothers, except for them owning The Shining, because it's in a different world. It's not a sequel to their movie. So I'm sure Flanagan, well, actually, the film didn't do very well at the box office, right? But if Flanagan found a way to get them to monetize The Shining that they did not have before, he would be a hero over there.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, better a Shining sequel than no Shining sequel, probably, as far as Warner Brothers is concerned. I mean, I think it was projected to make $25 million at the U.S. box office and made 14 or something like that. So that's a pretty, I mean, $25 million was not that big to begin with, but that's a pretty dramatic difference. And it's, you know, it's not going to go up from there. So I think it's kind of a, you know, box office dud at this point. I mean, horror movies are notoriously steep drop-offs. I mean, they tend to have big opening weekends and then vanish. And this one did not even have a big opening weekend, so it's pretty much done. As someone who's interested in Mike Flanagan, I think it was interesting to see. Like, it's interesting to me to see him get this like big, huge toolbox and be able to do this. You know, to like, you know, build these huge sets that he can do these huge Steadicam shots down. And the fact that he has to be rebuilding Stanley Kubrick sets in order to do that is, partly just, it's just like, it's just kind of the world we live in, which is unfortunate, but it is also, this is, you know, it's 2019. This is where we are.
I mean, if you have to meticulously recreate, the work of an earlier filmmaker, and that's the only way you can make movies, you could do worse than to do Stanley Kubrick's, but, But yeah, I agree with you. It's sort of depressing that that's where the money goes.
All right. So anyway, so we are, you know, building now to this final confrontation between Dan Torrance and Rose the Hat. Dan has, you know, decided that the Overlook is the place to stage this. He's not really explained why. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. There's some sort of connection between, you know, the True Knot and the ghosts in the Overlook, but they're definitely not the same. I mean, the, you know, the True Knot are corporeal figures who, you know, physically kill people. They are not ghosts, but they are both kind of attuned to the same, you know, psychic bandwidth or something. But anyway, so you know, Dan has lured Rose the Hat there. Abra is there as well. She is, you know, Ben waiting outside, but, you know, runs inside when Rose the Hat shows up. And so they build this confrontation. We end up back in the same giant hall with Jack Torrance's typewriter, you know, kind of still there on the table in the middle of it, the one where he typed "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy." As Rose the Hat is making her way towards the Overlook Hotel, we have, you know, what is probably the most, you know, direct reckoning of this movie with the legacy of the original, which is, you know, Dan Torrance is kind of making his way around the hotel, metaphorically revisiting old ghosts, and then he literally revisits one because he steps into the ballroom, pulls up to the bar to have a drink, and behind the bar is a figure who we will eventually quickly come to realize is the ghost of his father, Jack Torrance. Jack has been, as we know, he's always been the caretaker. He's still the caretaker. He's still tending bar there, hasn't any guests in a while. But he offers Danny a drink. And this is where this, you know, the alcoholism theme that you were talking about before, Decim, comes back in.
Yeah. So they, he's at the bar in the Gold Lounge, and they sort of recreate the alcoholism scene from the movie and book of The Shining, in which this figure of Lloyd the bartender convinces Jack Torrance to have a drink, which is what sets him on his way. In this case, it's not Lloyd, although he says his name is Lloyd. It's clearly his father. And he gives him a speech about alcohol being medicine that sort of, you know, it takes the edge off speech. He tries to talk him into having a drink, which he doesn't do. And then does he just leave his dad at the bar and walk away? I don't remember how it ends. The bartender slides the glass off the table.
Yeah, I think he just says no and yeah, and just leaves. Like, I think that's, he resists temptation, and that's it. Yeah.
He looks at the drink. He doesn't take it. And at that point, the ghost disappears and he's back in the empty gold room. And the last thing is where he really starts pulling from stuff from Stephen King's novel, The Shining, that Kubrick didn't use. So it sort of jumps from recreations of scenes that happened to Jack Torrance in the novels are happening here to his son.
So now we're at the final confrontation between Rose the Hat and Dan. He has sent Abra off to kind of protect herself. There's a whole thing where they kind of lay a trap for her inside Dan's mind involving, you know, the Overlook's hedge maze. And then Rose the Hat realizes that she's not in Abra's mind. She's in Danny's mind. She comes out and she starts pinning him down and, pulling the steam out of him. And that's when she, you know, she goes into his mind and sees all these boxes that he has been trapping the ghosts of the Overlook in for, you know, the last, you know, 30, 40 years. And as she's pulling the steam out of him, she sees these, you know, boxes in his head. They're, you know, elaborately decorated. She thinks they must be very special. Dan says they're not special. They're starving. And he opens up all the boxes. And then all the Overlook ghosts come back, the ones that Dan's been seeing around the hotel. So, you know, the twin girls and the original Lloyd the bartender and the old lady and all the other, you know, figures, all the sort of, you know, Halloween costume party people from the original movie sort of stick their hands not only around, like put their hands not only on Rose the Hat, but sort of inside her. They kind of stick their hands under the skin on her face somehow and just like pull her apart. And she vanishes in a puff of steam. And that is the end of Rose the Hat.
But it is not the end of the Overlook Hotel.
Yes.
Dan Torrance is not doing great. And the hotel, these ghosts, having taken care of Rose the Hat, possess him and send him after Abra, who is a valuable target for the hotel, just as she was for Rose the Hat. And they recreate in the original book of The Shining. There's no hedge maze. Jack chases Danny around through the hotel With an axe, which is, with a roque mallet in the novel. In this case, it's an axe because it's an axe in the movies. But they recreate those sequences the way that the original book ended, this time with our hero, Ewan McGregor, chasing, you know, Edward, the main character, around like that. And they sort of recreate the end of the novel, which is that Jack Torrance is, in the novel, is supposed to maintain the Overlook's boiler room. When he's possessed, he forgets about it. And that's what happens here. We see in a flashback that as they arrived at the Overlook, Dan went to the basement, turned on the still functioning boiler and set it to blow up. And then, having been attacked by Rose the Hat and possessed by the hotel, has forgotten all about that. But as in the novel, The Shining, Dan Torrance, in this case, not Jack, runs down to the basement in an attempt to save the hotel and save the boiler, and does not succeed in that endeavor. The boiler explodes, killing Dan, as it killed Jack in the original novel of The Shining.
Right, and yeah, as I mentioned before, I mean, the original Shining ends with the boiler room blowing up the Overlook. So this is kind of Stephen King's sequel to The Shining, with the ending from Stephen King's book, The Shining, tacked onto the end of it. And I think, I mean, if you've read the book, you know, the second he goes into the boiler room, like, you know what's going to happen. So it's almost like a weird little Easter egg for people who have actually read the book. There's also this scene where, you know, it takes us into the boiler room. Danny is dying. He's got this wound in his leg. He's got this ghost coming after him. He's not going to make it out. He sends Abra out, kind of recovers himself long enough to free himself from the literal ghost of his father. So he's just, you know, sitting there in the boiler room, basically waiting for this place to blow. And there is, we get kind of he's revisited by another ghost. And this time it is the ghost of his mother, Wendy, you know, who he is finally sort of brought together with his ability to see people close to death. He initially visualized that as like flies landing on their bodies. So when his mother started dying, her face was just covered with flies and he couldn't even look at her and he couldn't see her face. So he wasn't there when she died. So then we get the shot of, you know, his mother, Wendy, played by Alex Esso, kind of coming back. And we get to see her face this time. And it's kind of this reconciliation between the two of them, kind of this moment of peace that Danny has finally found by going back and confronting this whole thing before the hotel blows up and he dies. I mean, this reminded me also like a little bit of the ending of The Haunting of Hill House, which kind of had a sort of similar kind of ghost reconciliation thing to it that played on a certain emotional level, but also made no sense with like the 9 hours of stuff that it's just like, this doesn't, like this kind of evil ghost that has been like orchestrating all this stuff just turns out to be like kind of like maybe good. This doesn't really, like there's no, like what's the moral here? Like if you survive a childhood trauma and it bothers you your whole life, you should just like blow up a building with yourself in it and you'll be at peace. Like, I don't really, I don't know what my takeaway is here, I guess.
Anyone who knows the answer to that can't tell us, right? It's two movies. It's this vampire story, and then it's tour the haunted Overlook Hotel for a half an hour. I think it's sort of sweet. There is, in the original Shining also, there's a moment where Jack Torrance briefly overcomes his possession and tells Danny to run and, you know, whatever, like comes back to himself. It's not like thematically wrong for this one to end with reconciliation the way it was, I think, thematically wrong for Hill House to do that. But it's strange. It's a strange thing. Like that moment in the basement of the boiler room does not seem like where you would want to put a big moment of reconciliation. But that's the end of the movie, so that's where it goes.
Yeah, that's the end of Dan Torrance, pretty much. And we do get a little tag after that. You know, as we mentioned, I think you know, Abra's father was killed by Crow Daddy. But so we get a little tag, you know, it's, you know, I think 6 months later or something like that. And we see Abra at home with her mom, and she basically does kind of the bumblebee pendant scene from The Sixth Sense, where she basically, you know, tells her mom, like, hey, you know, I can talk to dad and dad's fine and everything's okay. He doesn't matter. He's not upset that like a quasi immortal demon being stabbed him in the chest with a kitchen knife. Everything's cool. You know, dead people are fine with it. That's, and then we see in the final callback, as we see once again the rotting ghost woman who Dan, I guess, let out to kill Rose the Hat and has not been successfully somehow, even though the Overlook blew up, is still around and now is haunting Abra. And the last thing we see is her preparing to put the old lady back in a box. And scene.
I think it's a really interesting movie if you think about it as just sort of like, how on earth would you reconcile these stories that don't end in the same place and aren't really about the same thing? But if you're looking for a movie that is like terrifying, this isn't it.
Or quote unquote makes sense.
Also true.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Matthew Jessam, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
Yeah. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our audio engineer is Merritt Jacob. Our producer is Rosemary Belson. For Matthew Dessam, I'm Sam Adams. Thanks for listening.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
In my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.